they're going to be, you know, basically okaying and using their legitimacy as media to, you know, sign off on the eradication of children, women, and innocent men in this part of the world. And there's really no distinction in that sense. So thank goodness for news from Neptune and Higher Ground for giving people something else to listen to, because CNN and the others are not helpful on this front.
But, and then Fox is just
forget it.
Propagandist material. Well, MSNBC, which I don't track either. I know a lot of people watch it, and I think it's it doesn't expand the limits of allowable debate, as the Chomsky expression goes at all. It's just
two controlled opposition parties.
Stays within the parameters of and doesn't. You know, and you don't have enough time in to go to the next commercial. You have to keep everything concise. That's where the name of News from Neptune comes from. Is that the guy that started Nightline, you know, which started at the time of the hostage crisis in Iran, Grenfell, I don't know. He was asked why Chomsky's not on Nightline. He says because he's from Neptune. He can't talk. And Chomsky's response is, well, they give me I have a complicated issue that goes beyond the allowable limits of debate, and I need the time to explain the details of it. And you can't do that on soundbite TV.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, the system is set up in such a ways that you cannot break down all of the problems with our society in 45 seconds debate between two talking heads.
Beltway blinders. It's really just infotainment, not a very artful expression, but it's the one that pertains, I think.
Yeah. Well, Paul, I've eaten in two or three minutes into your show.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you stopping in. This was a great end to Higher Ground.
I wanted to get that up to... Carol was still on because I'm sure she could have explained the arguments that went on. And I hope some people do turn out or at least write the Urbana City Council and say, find a way to make this happen.
Yeah.
This is absurd.
Yeah. There's no excuse for not to happen. I will certainly be there. I have a feeling that you'll be there from what it sounds like.
I'm already rehearsing. In fact, this was my rehearsal. And you only get 3 minutes there. So.
Yeah.
But I think this argument that the... pandemic money should be used to fill in whatever gap they have that they have to protect because the bankers and the bond issuers insist.
Yeah. Yep. If they want to make it happen, they can. So anything, if they say anything other than that, know that something is being hidden. So.
All right. I already ran down. I have some web exclusive on the ICC. Or ICJ. I guess this one is the ICC. There are two courts. One of them deals with states, and the other deals with, individuals and war criminals. Okay. I actually have two segments on that. And then about a half-hour interview on the campus climate with a woman from The Intercept, interviewed by Brian Edwards Tekert. He's a morning host, does some really great work. And I'd like to tell you I'm all ready, but what I'm going to do here is I just checked, and there is a recent Mumia. He hasn't done it in a while, so I'm going to do this in a very unorthodox fashion, and it'll cut into the rest of the program. But, here is Mumi Abu-Jamal, End of Empire, ? Let's see.
I've studied the histories of empires, especially their rise and their fall. Europe's most illustrious example, Rome, grew from a city to a state and finally a world empire. When their men tired of fighting, they trained non-Romans in their war tactics. And when they were treated with contempt by Romans, they responded by sacking the city and stealing their treasure before leaving. It wasn't the end of Rome, but it was a signal of the beginning of the end. Empires rise and empires fall. That is a lesson of history. A century ago, Britain boasted that the sun would never set on the British Empire. A few world wars later, and after decolonization struggles, and it is an empire no more. This recent Brexit episode has cleaved its economic strength, and most foreign observers see it as a self-inflicted wound. It shows us that great empires can succumb to a kind of suicide. Now, what of the American empire? Is it immune to the lessons of history? Half a century ago, it lost a war to a poor Asian nation. After, it inflicted millions of casualties upon them. The country that won the war was called Vietnam. Just days ago, it elected an immoral man whose only real claim to fame was his bank account. Because of this election, America has no voice with which to tell other countries how to elect their leaders. It has no voice in questions of morality. It has great power, yes, but that didn't win in Vietnam, nor in Afghanistan, where they simply outweighed the Americans. Empires are not immortal. They may last for centuries, yes, but ultimately they rise and they fall. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Okay, that was sobering, but it did remind me that Chomsky has a response to that, and that is that in some dimensions, the Vietnam War was a success for the U.S. It reshaped the entire economy and power structure in Southeast Asia, impoverished the Vietnam for a long time. So, and U.S. interests did start going for the oil in offshore areas there because the Vietnamese couldn't stop it. Speaking of oil, Amy Goodman spent the week, I don't know if she's extending her stay in Baku or not, since the COP there is extended. Did I say opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station? I'll tell you that right now. And here's Amy's Breaking the Sound Barrier essay from Baku, Azerbaijan.
COP 29, the dictatorship of the petrolitariat. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast from Baku, Azerbaijan. COP 29, the 29th United Nations Conference of Parties to the Climate Convention, convened this year in Azerbaijan, a small authoritarian petrostate wedged between Russia and Iran on the shores of the Caspian Sea. The worsening climate catastrophe, fueled by the world's centuries-long embrace of fossil fuels, demands a united worldwide response from all nations, including authoritarian ones. But does the conference itself have to be held in a country where dissent is criminalized, protests are banned, and there's no free press nor right to free speech? The world's oil addiction arguably began in Baku. It was here in 1846 that the first industrial oil well was drilled. as revolution swept through Europe and beyond in 1848, and Karl Marx's newly published Communist Manifesto reminded workers that they had nothing to lose but their chains, humanity was busily chaining itself to fossil fuels. More than 175 years later, our ever-increasing burning of coal, oil, and gas has heated the planet with a cascade of catastrophic consequences, from more frequent and intense hurricanes and typhoons to wildfires, droughts, and tornadoes, increasing human suffering and driving mass migration. This crisis will only accelerate unless a comprehensive solution is negotiated, implemented, and enforced on a global scale. Which brings us to Baku and the fundamentally flawed decision to hold these vital talks in a place where speaking freely can get you arrested by the government of President Ilham Aliyev.
Azerbaijan has had an abysmal rights record for many years, but it has dramatically deteriorated in the run-up to COP29.
Georgi Gogia of the Europe and Central Asia Division of Human Rights Watch said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. He noted HRW has
documented 33 cases of arrests, new arrests and imprisonment of journalists, activists, human rights defenders, and just government critics on various bogus charges. And think about what this COP would have been like if they were there to voice their criticism, for their voices to be heard by the globe.
Others say the number of arrests prior to COP29 is closer to 300. Gubad Ibadoglu, an anti-corruption economist who's taught at the London School of Economics, is currently under house arrest. His crime? Demanding greater transparency in Azerbaijan's oil and gas revenues. In July 2023, Ibadoglu and his wife were violently arrested. He faces up to 17 years in prison. Their daughter, Jala Beramova, was also arrested and tortured.
I'm a human rights lawyer, but I was also working as an activist. I have been observing the elections, writing the cases to European Court of Human Rights.
Jala said on Democracy Now! From outside Azerbaijan.
As a result of all these tortures, I cannot sleep without a neck pillow as they injured my neck discs. They also crushed my ribs and my kneecaps.
Jala continued.
Before Ilham Aliyev, it was his father, who was also president of Azerbaijan during Soviet Union and a KGB general. And Ilham Aliyev, as it seems, getting his son to get ready to succeed himself. And his wife is a vice president of Azerbaijan. So it's more like a monarchy. It's a family affair, in a sense, and they own everything.
The climate summit is housed in Baku's main sports stadium and several adjoining temporary structures in a secure space dubbed the Blue Zone, where the UN controls security and sets the rules. In this Potemkin village, protest is tolerated if pre-authorized and then only at specified locations and times. At one official site, protesters can make noise, give speeches, or even sing. At the other site, only silent protest is permitted, with allowances for soft humming and finger snapping due to its proximity to meeting rooms, the UN says. But behind the closed doors of those meeting rooms, where the future of the planet's climate is being decided, the more than 1,700 fossil fuel lobbyists registered for COP29 are able to speak freely, to mingle with government delegations, to influence the course of the negotiations uninterrupted by the silent protests outside. Global petroleum production and consumption are at an all-time high. While 2024 is set to be the hottest year on record, trumping last year's record heat. Science tells us that the worst impacts of the climate emergency still can be avoided if urgent and ambitious action is taken. Autocrats like Ilham Aliyev and aspiring autocrats like Donald Trump love the wealth and power that flow from oil. Trump has already promised to withdraw from the Paris Agreement again. Grassroots movements and global solidarity will be needed as people fight the twin threats of authoritarianism and climate change in these coming crisis years. These difficult times recall the words of 20th century philosopher Antonio Gramsci, imprisoned by the Italian fascist Mussolini for 12 years until his death. In his prison writings, translated from Italian, Gramsci wrote, "The old world is dying, and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters." From Baku, Azerbaijan, I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
One of my favorite quotes, and it's gotten even more monstrous. Oh, we didn't do any reviewing of the junk drawer. That's what I'm calling the Trump cabinet, by the way. There was this big fight amongst his followers about who would get the Treasury and who would get Commerce, and the guy that Elon Musk wanted for Commerce didn't get it. He got it, the Treasury Department instead. Yeah, it is really monstrous times. Sebastian Gorka got his place. I just wrote on a Facebook post that it's really great that an old school Nazi got in the junk drawer. Sebastian Gorka, at the inauguration, the first Trump, wore this insignia that people figured out what it was. It's about the Hungarian Nazi Sympathizers Party. I forget what it's called. But I posted a Times of Israel article. Sebastian Gorka, Nazi. And that was one of the first articles that came up. So did I say opinions are those of the speakers? I guess I did, but I didn't play an underwriting announcement, so why don't I take care of some business here for the station? I've always talked about whether the chess club would do an underwriting announcement, but I don't know if there is a chess club. Everybody plays it online now, and so they don't get together and have those timers and stuff, and maybe they do. Anyway, I'm wasting some more time. Here's a small business in the community. Park districts do it as well. There'd be other ways of creatively getting your name mentioned here on community radio. Appreciate all the support. Listener donor is the main thing, and we appreciate that. You can do that anytime. You can set up a payment plan and do more. It's now more than ever, I've been saying.
Part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That's ELLIOTT Counseling Group, no punctuation or spaces.com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.
Okay, I'm trying to edit on the fly, realizing I have more material than I can. Amy Goodman played part of this, but she had a web exclusive on a reaction to the international courts issuing the warrants. So here's a Palestinian authority. I also have another piece from another producer at KPFA, and then the campus climate. Perhaps I will excerpt the other one on this issue as well. But this was recorded on the fly from Azerbaijan as a breaking news story. Again, it's a web exclusive. Part of it was aired yesterday, but this part I'm pretty sure wasn't. So.
...2021, 2022, and 2023 May. So the reason why we went to the ICC wasn't related with this last offensive of October. It's for the crimes against humanity, persecution Israel carried against the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Settlements, the Judaization of Jerusalem, the annexation of Jerusalem, the bypass road, the annexation apartheid wall, the incursions of cities, villages, and camps in the West Bank, the blockade on Gaza, and all these wars, these were the reasons. We are having criminal belligerent occupation, who did horrific war crimes and crimes against humanity against Palestinian civilians. International law, international humanitarian law are there to protect civilians at the time of war. And that's why we resorted to it. When we failed in achieving justice in universal jurisdiction, we went to the ICC, the court for no man's court. Nobody ever talked about just or fair occupation. Occupation by itself, crime of aggression. And I don't think this Israeli occupation is just or fair. What we were shocked of, not what after October 7th, the president of Israel said, or the prime minister, or the minister of defense. The prime minister of Israel said Gaza should leave Gaza. And the Israeli president said, there is no innocent civilian in Gaza. All are complicit, and they all will be targeted. And the minister of defense said there will be no water, no medicine, no food, no fuel for Gazans. And they began, I mean, their genocide attack against Gaza and Gazans for the last 13 months. And the entire world witnessed that live on air at the real time. And this was reported and documented by many. Now, that's why we resorted, I mean, to the ICC once and again, reminding Mr. Khan that genocide is part of this, and the ICC should activate its role and complete the mission of the investigation which Fatou Bensouda dealt when she was the prosecutor. And unfortunately, 43 years, he moved nowhere. And he moved, I mean, in last May, which is good, but he tried even to be politically balanced, and that's why he brought Palestinians and Israelis. Israel, obviously and clearly, showed that they are doing genocide, and genocide, usually the most important part of it are to prove is the intent. But the intent was from day one, simple, clear, direct, and said by Israeli key figures, the president, the prime minister, the minister of defense, and tens of the Israeli ministers, political party leaders, army leaders, and it's all over the place. Now, we are having this situation now. We are having a warrant issued by the pre-trial chamber by the consensus of three judges. This is not the end of the process, but this shows once and again moral legal superiority on a criminal occupation doing genocide against the Palestinian people in the occupied territories, precisely, I mean, in the Gaza Strip. There is a long way to go, and we will fight for it till we have these suspected criminals being held accountable in the Court of Justice. And we are sure that we are going to deliver, and this dream will be realized.
Well, Raju Sarani, could you respond to the way that the Israeli prime minister has responded to this news? The prime minister's office declared in a statement on Thursday that the ICC's anti-Semitic decision to issue arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant is, quote, equivalent to a modern Dreyfus trial. Your response, Raju Sarani?
I mean, no new news in this. They are very arrogant. They are very jealous. The West, especially U.S. and Europe, made Israel feel they will never, ever, they will be held accountable. They feel they are immune. They are doing all what they are doing at the daylight, and they don't hide it. They attack children cancer hospitals at the daylight. They attack hospitals and doctors. They rape prisoners by the army and the army detention centers. They kill women, children at the daylight. They starve people. They criminalize UNRWA, the body which should serve the Palestinian refugees in the Gaza Strip, the only body which is doing and delivering that. And nobody holds them accountable. Look, last night, this ugly veto of the U.S. to the Security Council against ceasefire, just to stop genocide, by whom we are killed, by which bombs and missiles and airplanes. It's American. It's European. They feel they are fully immune. They are free to do whatever they can. They will never be held accountable. And why their appetite for crimes going like a snowball every day, like now they are talking publicly. We're cleaning Gaza from these 2.5 million people, and we will settle in it, and the settlers will be there. And they began to sell the land of Gaza to the settlers and to sell the apartments. And they declared their intention about West Bank and the cleaning. This is unprecedented that such state, Israel, having all these crimes were crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide, and just be dealt normally. This criminal, while he's doing genocide, he came to the Congress and he was received by everybody, and everybody was applauding him and his acts more than the president of the United States. So, unfortunately, Raji, this makes them feel too much arrogant, and they feel, you know, just safe. And that's why he's shocked and reacted this way. He's a criminal. He deserves accountability.
In May, the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, suggested the Biden administration could work with Congress to sanction the ICC after news broke that the court was considering arrest warrants for Netanyahu and other top Israeli leaders. Go back 20 years to 2002. U.S. law, often referred to as the Hague Invasion Act, gives the U.S. president the power to invade the Netherlands to protect Americans who would be brought up before the International Criminal Court. Some defenders of Israel have called on the U.S. to invoke the act in defense of Israeli leaders. We're not only talking about the Biden administration right now, but soon President Donald Trump will be in office. Your final response, and we just have a minute. Do you actually think that this is a possibility?
I have no idea, I mean, what President Trump will do. But I know they tried all the way long to protect Israel and the Israeli politicians, quote-unquote criminals, who are doing all these crimes all the way long. I am sure that international community will not allow that. And the initial responses we received, whether from Borrell, the EU, fantastic, and he said, it's not a political decision, this is our decision, we are going to implement. France, the same thing. And I think, I mean, in Europe, this will be followed. U.S. is not the master of the world, and they cannot be the master of the world. America can be great when they respect the rule of law, not the rule of jungle. And Palestinians are not the slaves of the old Rome. In the old Rome, there was two classes, slaves and masters, and the law was applicable for masters, and slaves you can slaughter at the daylight and nobody hold you accountable. We are not going to be good victims for anybody. We, as a Palestinians, deserve justice and dignity. We will fight for the rule of law, and we'll join the forces with all the free committed people across the globe till this criminal occupation end, till these war crimes stops, till this genocide come to an end, until those criminals, Netanyahu, Gallant, and all the entourage, being held accountable at the court of law for the crimes they committed. We are not going to forget or forgive all those crimes they committed against Palestinian children and women.
Raji Sarani, we thank you so much for being with us. Raji Sarani, award-winning human rights lawyer, founder and director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza. He's also the 2013 Right Livelihood Award laureate and also won the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Prize. He's now speaking to us from Cairo, Egypt, after his house was bombed, though he and his family were able to get out of Gaza. He was born in Gaza City in 1953. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Okay, that was a web exclusive. And part of it was broadcast yesterday. You can find the entirety. I elided the first part because I'm pretty sure that was the part that was broadcast. Brian Edwards Tekert also called a Palestinian lawyer. I think this is somebody that's at UC Berkeley. George Bisharat, I believe I met him at a Palestinian rights human conference many decades ago. They took place in Chicago regularly for a while, and I attended a series of them annually. I've got about 40 minutes of material and half hour left of the show. Radio Free Labor won't be in full complement, but I'm pretty sure Gus Wood and Bob Pelesny will be in, talk about some of the labor stories that are going on. I guess the most recent appointment was of Department of Labor, and it was somebody that the Teamsters Union guy preferred. He's the guy that talked at the convention, forgetting the names of the woman that was the least objectionable for Department of Labor. These right populists, and the number of Project 2025 people is mounting up, and Google Sebastian Gorka Nazi and you'll find an interesting story. I already mentioned that again, but it's pretty astonishing. I guess I'll excerpt the part with we'll listen to all of this, since it is such a monumental thing to have this indictment go out for Gallant and Netanyahu, and then part of the Brian Edwards Tekert interview on another day with a journalist from the Intercept. All right, sorry about all of the lapses here. Let's hear Brian Edwards Tekert on the morning show called Upfront, which is available as a podcast.
Criminal court issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, along with allegedly assassinated Hamas leader Mohammed Daif. The Israeli leaders are charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity. Although since Israel is not a signatory to the Rome Statute, they do not face arrest in their own country. This may, at a very minimum, restrict their travel options in the future. Joining us to talk about the situation, George Bisharat, Professor Emeritus at University of California College of Law, San Francisco, where his research and writing have focused on international legal aspects of Palestine-Israel. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
Why don't you start by walking us through the charges and what, like, evidentiary standards the prosecutor, Karim Khan, had to meet to get arrest warrants?
Well, Khan had to present evidence of reasonable grounds that the two leaders, the two Israeli leaders, plus the presumed deceased Hamas leader Mohammed Daif, committed crimes that are prosecutable under the Rome Statute. The specific crimes that were presented in the application for the warrant included murder, persecution, extermination, and extermination involves the large-scale intentional killings of civilians and the use of starvation as a weapon of war. Those were among the allegations against the Israeli leaders. The court did not mention the crime of extermination in its granting of the warrant, but it did refer to starvation, persecution, murder, and other inhumane acts. So a relatively minimal evidentiary standard, which is typical at a charging stage, at an application for a warrant stage, in law generally, including here in the United States.
a minimal standard, an abundance of evidence in pretty much every evening newscast and on every social media platform. Why did it take 6 months from when Khan requested the warrants to this three-judge panel issuing them?
Well, I can't answer that question really without knowing sort of the internal politics. There was a shift of a judge. There was a judge who stepped down and was replaced. That can always lead to delay. If you look at the trajectory of the investigation of crimes committed by Israeli leaders against Palestinians over the last 10 years or so, it seems, however, that there has been a lot of foot dragging, a lot of reluctance. And we should not overlook, at least for some period of that time, there was direct Israeli pressure and probably U.S. pressure as well on the court not to bring charges against Israel. It was revealed earlier this year, for example, that the Mossad, that is the Israeli External Intelligence Agency, had been threatening the former prosecutor, Fatou Ben Souda, and had been threatening her family as a means of dissuading her from bringing charges against Israel. I can only speculate as to whether there was similar such pressure that caused this sort of long delay. And by the way, let's contrast this with the charges that were brought against Vladimir Putin one day after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The court can act quickly when it wants to, and in the absence of, or in perhaps in light of pressure from to prosecute. I can't really say with any certainty what caused this particular delay. Just the observation over a long period of time that the court has been very slow to bring charges against Israeli leaders.
So the court doesn't command its own police force. They are not sending people into Jerusalem to haul Benjamin Netanyahu out in handcuffs. What are the practical consequences of the arrest warrants being out there?
Courts generally, of course, don't have their own police forces and rely on law enforcement to enforce their judgments. In the case of the ICC, the International Criminal Court, it relies on the law enforcement of its 124 members, those who have signed on to the Rome Statute and who are bound to enforce its arrest warrants and judgments and the like. The practical import, therefore, is that the Israeli leaders are inhibited from traveling to any of those 124 nations, or at least most of those nations. That includes the 124 includes all of Latin America, most of Africa, a number of Asian countries, Western Europe, Canada, Australia, et cetera. And several states which are typically allies of Israel have already said that they will stand up for international law and they will enforce these arrest warrants if the Israeli leaders travel to their territory. Those nations include Canada and the Netherlands. And the French also have said that they will enforce these arrest warrants. A few other countries have waffled a little bit. The UK and Germany have been a little bit equivocal. And then, of course, you have Hungary, which is a member state, actually issuing an invitation to the Israeli leaders to travel there in defiance of the arrest warrants.
Right. I mean, this is a move that, Vladimir Putin did. He has an arrest warrant out against him over the Russian invasion of Ukraine. He traveled to Mongolia, a country
Correct.
That is tightly economically and politically tied to Russia, but is also Yes. a signatory to the Rome Statute, just to kind of prove he could without consequences.
Perhaps so, yes. And we can expect that kind of actions from the Israeli leaders and those in the international community, like Viktor Orban of Hungary, to sort of disprove or to contest the arrest warrants. But I think it's a very significant fact that the arrest warrants have been issued. And, there are a number of very, very close allies of Israel that are speaking out in favor of international law and in support of the arrest warrants. And I think that's a very significant development and a good day, honestly, for international law and for the independence of the International Criminal Court. The ICC has been justly, I think, criticized for years for mostly being an instrument for the prosecution of African warlords and other opponents of the West, other adversaries of the West. And this is the first time that the leaders of a Western allied nation have actually been indicted for their war crimes. And that's certainly war crimes and crimes against humanity. That's not because they are the first to have committed them. And so this action, I think, is long overdue, and it should be embraced and welcomed by anybody who supports the universal application of international law, not simply the exploitation of international law as an instrument of Western power.
That's George Bisharat on a show called Upfront with Brian's Edwards Teekert. I'll apologize to him. Well, I'm going to go on to another segment that he did a different day. This is from November 22nd, just yesterday. Bisharat is Professor Emeritus at UCAL San Fran College of Law, not UCAL Berkeley, as I might have said at the beginning. Here's Brian Edwards Teekert with Ms. He'll introduce her. This segment is about campus politics. She does a case study of Case Western in, I guess that's Cleveland?
4 years ahead. And we're going to start this morning with the situation on U.S. campuses, which were a hotbed of political activity a few months into Israel's bombardment and invasion of Gaza, but have since seen a crackdown on that kind of campus activism. Universities are strange entities because without actually engaging in the criminal legal justice process and triggering the due process rights that defendants have under it, they can completely derail the lives and careers of their students with academic disciplinary actions. Our next guest, Keila Lacey, is a senior politics reporter at The Intercept who's been covering the crackdown on campus, most recently in a long article taking a look at the situation at Case Western, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and University of Pennsylvania. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your case study is Case Western University in Cleveland. Why don't you describe the situation there?
Sure. So Case Western is a school that, you know, like hundreds of other schools across the country, had widespread encampment protests against the war in Gaza last spring. We began covering what was going on at Case Western through a short documentary with a film organization called 100 Days in Appalachia, trying to focus on some of the schools in, you know, away from the coasts, away from the Columbias of the world, where, you know, students, many of whom are coming from working class backgrounds, were also risking their academic positions and their futures to demonstrate against this war. You know, hundreds of students faced arrest and other disciplinary charges across the country, but at Case, there was a significant effort by school administrators to really single out and make an example of the undergraduate leader of the Students for Justice in Palestine chapter, Yusuf Khalif, who was the only student who the school banned from campus until spring of 2025, and the only school or the only student who the school hired an outside law firm to handle his case. Yusuf is, you know, still waiting to be able to graduate. He hasn't been able to return to campus to proceed with his academic career. And he's also facing, you know, a really intense sort of witch hunt from the administration. But this, again, is just one of dozens and hundreds of examples of not just students, but also faculty members, staff, adjunct lecturers, other people who have been swept up in these crackdowns. And the peg around this story was that last week, police at Case Western arrested four students in connection with spray paint and charged them with felony vandalism charges for posting spray paint around the campus that the school claimed was anti-Semitic, but it only showed paint with the names of countries like Palestine, Sudan, and Haiti, and signs that said "Your school funds genocide." Those students were transferred from Case police custody to the Cuyahoga County Jail, which is notorious for issues with solitary confinement and other human rights abuses. So this is just a snapshot of what students are facing, not just at Case Western, but all over the country.
It's a pretty big step on most campuses to bring in police to deal with students. A lot of campuses have their own like quasi-judicial processes, their own campus security forces. They like to keep their names out of the police blotter.
Yeah, and that's why it was so alarming, I think, when police or when schools called in police forces. We saw this, you know, across the country last year. There is not really a precedent for that kind of cooperation or urging police, you know, city police to come onto campus. You know, this was something that we talked about specifically at the University of Pennsylvania, which called in riot gear, like police in riot gear, to storm the home of several student activists. I believe this was last month. We wrote this story. Who were, again, suspected of alleged vandalism on campus. So we see these really disproportionate responses from schools, particularly in the case of UPenn, where they have one of the largest campus police departments in the country and have historically sort of claimed and prided themselves on not bringing city police into to student student business. And this was just another example of the exceptions that they're making around that when they're trying to target students who are using their First Amendment rights to protest against the war on Gaza.
And to be clear, this is bringing the police in to raid students' homes long after the alleged act of vandalism. It's not like an emergency right. situation where the campus was calling in police to deal with crowd control during a mass demonstration or help clear an encampment.
Not at all. These were in the early, this particular raid in West Philly was in the early hours of the morning. Students were, woken up by police sort of banging down their door, cops in full riot gear storming into the house for an incident that had taken place over a month before. So, we can just imagine the situation. I don't see a scenario in which police would be campus administrators would take these sorts of actions against students protesting in support of Israel, for example. You can really see the stark difference and discriminatory practices against students when they happen to be involved or connected in any way with advocacy for Palestine. And again, the allegations that police are responding to here, it's paint on a statue, it's paint on a school building. These are not violent actions. These are not any sort of alleged offenses that would warrant, police storming in riot gear. And the other piece here is that the school is taking extreme risks in allowing a raid like the one at Penn to happen, because had a student been injured, God forbid, a police officer's firearm, went off by accident. The student said that they pointed guns at them, in the early morning hours of this raid. There's confusion. There's lots of room for error. And the schools don't seem to be, caring about that risk.
I want to return to Case Western in Cleveland, private university. You mentioned Yusef Khalif, the undergraduate president of the chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine there, who got suspended. Among other things, the thing cited in the proceeding that suspended him was his chanting the slogan "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free."
Yeah.
Viewpoint-based discipline is pretty anathema to the idea of academic freedom. It also opens up the potential for free speech lawsuits. What do you think is going on here?
Well, I think schools are really responding sort of frantically to pressure from donors, state funders in situations where schools do receive state funding. Obviously, Case is a private university, but it's been the case in many of these crackdowns that we've covered where donors are the ones really, sort of driving the school's response here, whether they're threatening to withhold funding. And so that sort of negates any of the ideal sort of process here where the school would be, handling this like any other case that they would handle free speech in. And the irony with these cases is that, the argument that one student can't say the chant, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," is that it's infringing on the speech of other students who might not agree with that. And I think what schools are not missing, but what they're willfully ignoring here is that the dam on this issue is breaking. There used to be a time where you could, make a claim that any sort of criticism of Israel was anti-Semitic, and people were chilled into silence around that because you don't want to be accused of anti-Semitism. There are two effects of that sort of dynamic, which is that it cheapens the word, and which makes it harder to actually to address real cases of anti-Semitism, which are which exist and are a problem, and instead focus on activism that is connected to Palestine in a way that makes it impossible to even express solidarity with people who are under siege. So the role of donors here is a big one, but I think it's come up in pretty much every interview that I've done on these issues that campuses are ignoring the hypocrisy here in claiming that they're upholding free speech while severely restricting it for political reasons. We've seen this also in the numerous changes to campus protest policy that were enacted after protests this last spring and in ahead of this fall, where there's new rules for when you have to get permission from the school to hold a protest, how many people can be there. At Case, I believe this, you can't use a microphone or a bullhorn at protests anymore. And these are all direct responses to protests, for Palestine. So, the idea that there's any sort of, the free speech argument has been totally, hollowed out, turned on its head. This is something that schools just are refusing to sort of acknowledge, even though it's like a very blatant dynamic that students, protesters, advocates, lawyers, the ACLU has called out repeatedly, that this is clearly a violation of First Amendment rights and free speech. And that's, you mentioned legal suits. I mean, there's tons of lawsuits right now from students over these things. And the courts have been, generally ruling in students' favors because the law is extremely clear cut. And so the idea that schools are willing to not only put up the money to defend those lawsuits, even though, the precedent is extremely clear, just speaks to really how concerned they are about losing donors who might be pro-Israel.
Let's talk about how the universities justify this. Were you able to get any comment or explanation from the administration of Case Western?
They said that they can't comment on, in terms of the arrest that happened last week, they said they couldn't comment on pending investigations. I've reviewed some documents, that speak a little bit to the school's position, but, they're kind of so deep into this that, none of it makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, Case Western spent more than $250,000 on, tearing down the encampments and remediating campus after, painting over a spirit wall that protesters had painted on campus, sort of showing solidarity with Palestine. And they're blaming protesters for the cost. The school did not have to make the decision to spend that money to do any of that stuff. They could have just let the encampments go on and leave the spirit wall up, treat them the way that they treat other protesters on campus. But so we see really the schools digging in, treating students as threats and enemies, treating them as burdens on the school's financial system, threats to other students on campus, really sort of just completely detached from reality. The other schools that we've tried to get in touch with have mostly declined to comment and pointed us towards public statements that the university has already made. In the case of University of Maryland, where we wrote about how the school tried to they originally supported a protest that was put on by a chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace and a chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine on the anniversary of October 7th last year that they later canceled under pressure from donors. I asked them about this and they pointed me to a statement from the president that, in one breath upheld, the university's commitment to free speech and in the next said, and for that reason, we have to cancel this protest because a lot of people complain to us. So, they're not really... they're not really making a coherent argument in any of these cases. And I think that's why you see so many of the lawsuits going in students' favors, because judges are looking at this and saying, there's no argument that, there's no validity to the argument that the schools are making here, which is often, we did this because our donors are upset. We did this because we got outreach from the community, without acknowledging that students on campus are also part of the community. Students who are protesting these things are part of the community, and they're basically telling those students, there's no room for you here.
Right. And if your theory that this is all in response to donor pressure is correct, it would make sense that it's more important to the administration to be seen trying to crack down on student protesters than to actually have their actions upheld in court.
Exactly.
The important thing is what they're signaling about their intent.
Exactly.
Well, they must be justifying the new campus protest policies. Case Western has required political protests of more than 20 students to get a permit. I presume they are not doing the same thing for crowds associated with sports activities.
Right. Right. No, it's all very politically, separated here. These were put in place as a direct response to the protests last spring. And so, and just in my conversations with student activists and faculty on campus, they are they're already in this antagonistic position towards students who happen to be, have sympathy for the Palestinian cause or whose actions are directly, in protest of the war. So it's pretty clear that these new policies are directed at a particular kind of student, a particular kind of protest. I haven't seen or heard of examples where other, students, counter-protesting or protesting in support of Israel have had to deal with these sorts of regulations. But, I'm sure that those things will come up as the semester continues. You can also see sort of the different treatment in just the conversations that students are able to have with administrators. Like Students for Justice in Palestine, many of the chapters have told me, about how they've attempted to have meetings with administrators and been shut down, where other groups that, you know, are supportive of Israel or in line with the administration's approach on this, you know, have meetings with them all the time, have a great relationship with them. And so it's, yeah, it's the justification of the policies is, you know, again, don't do what you did last year. Don't create these problems for us that you did last year. And that only applies to certain students and certain protesters. You know, schools have been preparing for how they were going to respond to these protests, how they were going to handle any additional protests that popped up on campus in the fall. There was a conference over the summer where I think more than 400 people, professionals and public safety experts and people in academia went to this conference to basically discuss, like, how do we deal with this? How do we address, you know, future protests? How do we address loose ends from last year? And it's all because these protests happen to be in support of Palestine.
So I think we should tack a coat on to this, which is that all of this is everything you reported on took place before the election results.
Yes.
Even private colleges like Case Western have a lot of leverage points that can be exploited by the federal government. They count on federally underwritten student loans and Pell Grants to be part of their student financial aid packages. They compete for federal grants, don't want to be ruled ineligible for that. They require periodic recertification in order to get those things. I mean, what do you think campus politics look like with someone like Linda McMahon in charge of the Department of Education?
Well, the Trump administration has been extremely clear how they view protesters, whether it's protesters in support of Palestine or protesters, you know, like protesting police brutality back in 2020. Just yesterday there was this is not a campus example, but just to sort of give another anecdote about this, there was a group of protesters who did a demonstration in a Senate building to push Congress to vote for the Bernie Sanders bill blocking the latest $20 billion weapons sale to Israel. And Senator Tom Cotton tweeted like, you know, this has been allowed for too long, and like it won't be allowed for much longer. Basically, like we're anticipating extreme crackdowns. You know, more charges, criminal charges, more attempts to criminalize protests, particularly around Palestine. So, I certainly think that schools are anticipating that at this point. But again, this all happened. This posturing, this sort of caving to the pressures, external pressures, whether it's from donors or state or federal funders, you know, was all happening under Biden. But I think we'll see, you know, sort of more obsequious responses from universities, particularly when the Trump administration is more overt about what they plan to do here. You know, even in California, I think there was some talk where Gavin Newsom had made a comment about, you know, cutting funding from UC schools if they didn't crack down on protesters. So this is not, you know, a partisan thing. But again, the Trump administration is much more explicit about what they're doing. And so I think it will give schools more cover to continue these crackdowns, which is extremely alarming and why we thought it was really important to bring to light the fact that these cases didn't end last summer. You know, they're dragging on. You know, a lot of the students who were arrested at UC Irvine, you know, could have their, if they go to trial, they could drag into January and February of next year. So we're talking about, you know, months and months. You know, this is just not just time, it's resources, it's energy, it's taking students off of their path to graduation, which, you know, prohibits them from being able to get jobs. And so these have ripple effects that we haven't even begun to discuss. It's very, very concerning, the idea that the Trump administration would be more explicit and sort of more absurd in its interpretation of these events, and that would give schools more leeway to do more of what we've seen them doing.
Right. Not to mention that for anyone here on a student visa, academic discipline could be a ticket to deportation. Akilah Lacey, that's all the time we have this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Akilah Lacey is a senior politics reporter at The Intercept. That takes us to 7:30 in the morning. The show is Up Front. My name is Brian Edwards-Teeger.
And he's a great producer out at KPFA. He's got a morning show again, Up Front. It's available as a podcast, and you can hear the George Bisharat, who turns out blows a mean blues harmonica.
Yes.
Mr. Blues over here, Bob Polizny, has informed me, and I'm a College of Law emeritus professor and blues harpist. All right, that was supposed to be the time I was going to use to update a little bit. Hopefully we're getting an article about the arguments going on at the Student Senate about the new speech code on campus. The U of I, of course, didn't have anything negative to say about felony charges of mob action against nonviolent demonstrators that the local state's attorney presented, and they're still fighting those. Maybe they want a plea bargain? I don't know. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And I'm behind one thing that I have to do here, but here's an underwriting announcement. I guess this might be the right one. Okay. Oh, I want to do the Krannert one, yeah.
This hour of programming is brought to you by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts and the listeners of WEFT. For over 50 years, Krannert Center has presented diverse performances in music theater and dance from around the world and right here in Champaign-Urbana. Visit KrannertCenter.com for their complete calendar of events and to purchase tickets. Krannert Center, because the arts matter.